Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Lisa M. Mendoza, Lawrence M. Reifner, and Derek H. M. Chan presiding. In no hold law, please be seated. Calling case number CAAP-16-0000211, consolidated with CAAP-16-0000581, and CAAP-16-0000622. Victoria Ward Center LLC, Kelly Coffey Pellet versus Bold Guys Holdings LLC, doing business as Bold Guys Hawaii LLC, Appellate Coffey, and Shane A. McGuire, Appellate Coffey. Mark M. Murakami for Appellate Coffey. Fred M. Larson, Roja Piche, for Appellate Coffey. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, counsel.
Good morning.
Appearances, please.
Pardon?
Appearances, please.
Oh, yes. Leroy Colon, Your Honor, for the defendant's appellants, Bold Guy Holdings, LLC, Bold Guys Hawaii, LLC, and Shane McGuire. And I have with me Mr. Brett Larson, who's been admitted before the court for Roja Piche for this matter, of the Minneapolis firm of Mr. Lee Kramer. And Mr. Larson will be arguing this morning with the court.
All right, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm Mark Murakami on behalf of Appellate.
All right, good morning, Mr. Murakami. I understand that Gold Guys will argue first, 25 minutes. You save 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and then you'll do your 30 minutes in between.
Yes,
all right, let's begin. Mr. Larson.
May it please the court. First, I'd like to thank this court for indulging our client in a couple ways. One, in allowing for this hearing to occur, and two, for allowing me to present. It's an honor to present before this panel, and I appreciate it. We appreciate it. Our lead counsel, Phil Brown, retired to Colorado about a year after this appeal was filed, and he would have been happy to be here to present. I was present for all 6 days of trial, so we ended up with me here. We're here and we ask for an argument because this is an extremely important matter to the Gold Guys, to the business, and it's a unique case in that this appeal is based primarily on three distinct errors that the court acknowledged were related and compounded on one another. Now, these errors led to jury confusion about settled issues, exclusivity, harm, and the link between the two. Causing a result that was inconsistent with the evidence and inconsistent with the court's earlier rulings on summary judgment and motion in limine. I want to quote something that we heard from Judge Nakasone on the day after, or the hearing that we had after trial, on the motions for a new trial. She said, "What I am looking at is I do have a concern regarding the evidentiary error and the instructional error points that are made by Gold Guys. And my thoughts are, I think that this was an error in my part." Now, this was a unique case in that Gold Guys prevailed as a matter of law on liability and harm, and the trial court on that claim should have been really limited to the amount of damage. Instead, appellants were placed in the untenable position of having a favorable summary judgment decision, but being unable to talk about it, unable to reference it, even after respondents introduced testimony that was in violation of the court's motion in limine, a pretrial motion in limine, and in violation and inconsistent with the law of the case as established in the summary judgment order.
Well, on the matter that you quoted by the trial court, the court later went back and revisited the whole thing in the hearings certainly in her order, denying the motion for a new trial and for additure, et cetera, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The court acknowledged what she said were errors in the hearing. Orally, and then in the order, she indicated that on a second glance, she didn't think that they were errors, and if they were, they were not prejudicial. They were harmless error.
What's our standard of review for purposes of the issues that you are raising then, with regards to the exclusivity provision, prohibited radius issues, and even the jury instruction? I'm
yes,
interested
sir.
In that.
Great question. So the first issue is whether there was an error. And in our view, this is not the type of decision that where the court had to exercise its discretion in a traditional way in deciding to allow testimony in violation of the motion in limine. And in view of that, under Kealoha, it should be reviewed under a de novo standard. Now, Kealoha said that primarily in determining whether or not evidence, whether the court has the discretion to admit evidence in weighing factors, first, that should be reviewed de novo. And then if we get into a 403 type analysis where the court is weighing factors like harm, relative harm, then we should view that as under an abuse of discretion standard. So the court already had determined under 403 in its motion to eliminate that there would be no evidence of the order, the summary judgment order. There would be no testimony about exclusivity and prohibited radius. And then it allowed that testimony. And in any event, when the court admitted these errors, once we established that these errors occurred, and the primary argument that the court made in its order was that the errors were harmless. And so there are slightly different standards that apply to the three different errors that I'd like to talk about today. One, an error in admitting evidence is reversible if it is more probable than not that the error tainted the verdict. That is Powell v. Yosemite Park and Trask v. Kim cite a similarly stated standard about whether or not the error was prejudicial to the complaining party, the appealing party. The error in not allowing a cross-examination is reversible when it is prejudicial to the complaining party. That is Cosine, the Hawaiian catamaran. An error regarding a jury instruction is reversible when prejudicially insufficient, inconsistent, or misleading, and that is Kobashigawa v. Silva.
So let's back up just a little bit. I think I understand your position on in terms of if those are the circumstances. In other words, if in fact it was error to allow the testimony by Donna Farrell on the exclusivity. If I remember the circuit court's ruling, though, the ruling was that it was an error because it was just as to leases as opposed to licenses.
Yes, Your Honor. That was ultimately the argument that Attorney Sugimura made during the bench conference to Judge Nakasone. And I'd like to read the Farrell testimony, and then I can help to put it in context to explain how that could not have been the case. Donna Farrell stated, none of the retailers in our centers have exclusive agreements. The only ones that typically have exclusivity are anchor tenants or big box retailers, excluding Gold Guys from those definitions. And then a few moments later, Ms. Farrell actually explicitly stated that no, her understanding was the Gold Guys did not have exclusivity. And in understanding the context, this was day five of trial, after the jury instructions had already been read by the court and by Gold Guys counsel that there was exclusivity, that Ward breached the exclusivity clause, and that breach caused harm. Now on day five, they're told there is no exclusivity. So, yes, Attorney Sugimura argued to Judge Nakasone that this testimony came in the context of leases. But that's not true. This testimony was in response to questions about Gold Guy's response to the secured gold buyer's license in 2011. So Gold Guys get a license to operate in Ward Center. That license contains, as a matter of the law of this case, an exclusivity provision preventing Ward from leasing or licensing to a competitor within 10 miles. The Ward enters into a license with a competitor, secured gold buyers. Attorney Sugimura was questioning Ms. Farrell about Gold Guy's response and reaction to that. And in the context of that questioning, that's where this answer came about. And if you take a step back, Donna Farrell, the person testifying about these leasing practices and about this defense of duress, she wasn't even employed by Ward. She wasn't even employed by Howard Hughes when that lease was put in place. She wasn't the one actually putting that lease in place. And taking another step back, the defense of duress was based upon the take it or leave it proposal that was given to Gold Guys long before this conversation happened.
Just to be clear, your point is that Donna Farrell wasn't an employee at the time that the 2012 leases were entered into. Is that correct? Are you referring to the earlier?
No, I'm referring to the 2012 leases. So Ward's position is that, well, this testimony from Ms. Farrell was really about their leasing practices and really about the negotiations that led to the lease. She wasn't even an employee at the time they entered into the lease. She wasn't part of those negotiations. And the duress happened long before that, when Gold Guys stated, look, you breached the exclusivity provision. You leased to one of our competitors. You can't do this to us. And Ward said, well, you have two options. One, we're going to give secured gold buyers a long-term lease, and you can deal with that. Or you can take both.
Is that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. Or you can take both places, which it wasn't a great option, but at the time, trying to find a business solution, they took both. And the defense of duress was the defense to entering into that second lease. They never would have done it if they hadn't been given that take it or leave it option.
Donna Farrell left in August of 2011?
2012. Yes, Your Honor, August of 2011.
So is your point that she had nothing to do with the negotiations leading up to the 2012 leases, which were entered into in February,
she,
I think,
she
right?
She was involved in conversations, but she wasn't involved in the final conversations that led to the lease, and she wasn't there while the lease was put in place. And I guess more importantly for the context of why this came in and why it was confusing to the jury, this testimony came in asking about Gold Guy's response. Why were they so upset that secured gold buyers? There was a lot of testimony on that fifth day of trial about how Mr. Beasy was upset with Ward for leasing to a competitor. How could they do this? And the point that they were trying to make is that he had no reason to be upset. If I turn to another part of the testimony, they were making the case. This is a question from Ms. Sugimura to Ms. Farrell. What else did you tell Joe Beasy? This is, again, in response to his being upset about their leasing to secured gold buyers. Well, typically when a tenant is upset about us bringing in somebody who has similar business or a like product they're selling, I have had this happen, and it still happens, and I explain to tenants that none of the retailers in our centers have exclusive agreements. And we don't do that because we want to be able to offer our customers an opportunity to make business decisions and go and buy products and services from other stores that give the best deals. So they were clearly trying to confuse the jury and insinuate, if not state, that Gold Guys did not have exclusivity. So the next day, I'll back up. After that testimony came in, Mr. Brown asked for a bench conference. The court said overruled. Under 103A, that locks in the right to appeal. That was a final definitive ruling on the record, admitting or denying the evidence. Moments later, Mr. Brown is cross-examining Ms. Farrell to try to clarify, to try to bring her testimony in line with the law of the case, in line with the instructions that the court had already provided to the jury, to avoid confusion, to avoid them thinking, honestly, that we had been dishonest with them during the first day two through four. And being there, that was the feeling that came through. That is what came through that testimony, that the jurors felt that Gold Guys had been dishonest with them about their position and about the fact that they had exclusivity, because you had the leasing manager on the stand saying, no, they did not have exclusivity. We objected, and the objection was overruled. Mr. Brown is cross-examining Ms. Farrell. He gets to this point, and Attorney Sugimura objects. There's a bench conference. And during that bench conference, Mr. Brown says, I'm trying to find the quote. He says, This witness just factually stated there is no exclusivity in violation of this court's order when this court has settled this issue. That is another objection under Field and under 103A. And there, a bench conference ensued and a discussion ensued. And that is the second bench conference when Ms. Sugimura took the position that, well, this really just came in the context of the duress defense. And in the heat of the moment, there were a lot of things being said, a lot of arguments being made. She confused the trial court about the context of all of this and about how it was, how and what it all meant.
Mr. Larson, you mentioned earlier that in the prior day's testimony that the jury essentially had been given the impression, I'm not sure if through testimony or otherwise or opening, about the existence of an exclusivity provision that was held by Gold Guys, other than the opening argument, which I understand referenced the instruction that was in the January 2016 order, was there evidence or wasn't that precluded by this order?
Yes, Your Honor. So in a motion to eliminate, a pretrial motion to eliminate, the court prohibited us from eliciting testimony about the existence of the exclusivity right and about why it was so important to a business like Gold Guys, where they don't, it's not like they can differentiate based on having a better product. It's price, right? So the judge said, in lieu of allowing you to bring in that testimony, I will read this modified 3.5 to the jury. And that's what she did.
So to be clear, Mr. Brown argued it in opening argument.
Yes.
But there was no testimony of any kind up until Ms. Farrell testified about exclusivity provisions or prohibited radius provisions.
We were precluded from testifying about that topic and using those terms because the court was concerned about the prejudicial effect of communicating to the jury that the court had already, it was the court and Gold Guys against Ward, and that's what she was concerned about, is the credibility of the court, the full credibility of the court being behind Gold Guys and showing them an order. And in hindsight, she went so far in guarding against that it actually put us in a worse position than we would have been if we hadn't had a summary judgment decision at all.
So one other question I have is, in the testimony of Ms. Farrell, there's references to either emails or letters that I believe were in evidence. Are those in evidence, and do they reference exclusivity in those correspondence?
They don't specifically reference the word exclusivity, I don't believe, and they don't specifically reference prohibited radius. They do acknowledge that Gold Guys, so the back and forth, the emails were about the concept and about the Gold Guys being unhappy that Ward had leased to a competitor, and they're going back and forth about that idea. And that email chain ended with Melissa Pruis, one of the employees of Ward, saying, my conscience is bothering me about this. About this ordeal. And that's the email chain that was referenced. But again, we were precluded from entering any evidence and using the words exclusivity or using the words prohibited radius. And in lieu of being able to present that evidence, the court read that modified jury instruction.
At what point, other than after the evidence was closed?
Initially, the court read the originally modified jury instruction that everybody agreed upon. Just after closing, before we put our first witness on.
After opening.
I'm sorry, yes, after opening, before we put our first witness on. So she read the jury instruction, the modified jury instruction that both parties agreed to, and it said, it has been determined that Plaintiff Ward Center breached the 2011 license agreement and harmed defendant Gold Guys. So that is the modified jury instruction that the jury heard on day two. Then on day five, Ms. Farrell testifies twice that Gold Guys don't have exclusivity. We're prohibited from cross-examining her. Cross-examination, as you know, Your Honors, is a fundamental right. Gold Guys should have been able to cross-examine Ms. Farrell with the fact and in the conclusion of law that had already been decided that her testimony was incorrect. Now, she flew in from California that day. She was obviously prepared to testify to this event. It seemed clear that she hadn't been given information about the motion to eliminate that had been decided a couple days earlier. And so she may have been prepared to testify on exclusivity, prior to that motion in limine coming in, but her testimony couldn't have been more inconsistent with the motion in limine and the summary judgment. So the Golgi should have been allowed to correct that misunderstanding that was created, and that was exacerbated by the jury instruction, which was changed. And the change in the jury instruction on the last day of trial, the jury instructions were all handed to us in a packet. There was no reference to a new modified 3.5, an amended modified 3.5, just the packet. And we had already previously agreed on 3.5. The parties agreed. The court read it to the jury. There was no reason to think that it would change. Well, it changed. And it changed to remove the statement about harm and the link of that harm to the breach of the exclusivity agreement.
And at that point, there was no objection made, though. Right.
At that point, in all honesty, it was not caught
until it was conveyed by the court to the jury.
Correct.
The attorneys heard it. And it was different.
And it was different. And there was no objection at that point, Your Honor.
Did the court refresh my recollection? Did the court ever explain
why it changed the jury instruction? No, it didn't. And if it had, you know, we would have objected. Our trial counsel would have objected right then and there. There was no explanation. There was no highlighting of it. The only question about whether or not we agreed to, and this is in the record, to modify 3.5 was whether we agreed to modify jury instruction 3.5. And our trial counsel believed when he said yes that we were confirming our agreement to the originally agreed upon modified jury instruction 3.5. But as we pointed out in Turner v. Willis, which is a Hawaii case, regardless, even if the trial court completely failed to object to a jury instruction, this court has the ability to recognize the error if the error is reversible in its opinion. I see that I've reached 25 minutes. I want to make sure that I answer any questions that you might have, but I also want to make sure I reserve some
time. I think you have 5 minutes left on your 25, is my understanding. So you're at 20.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I'm misreading the light system. Thank you.
So the court did not give you the instructions prior to settling on the record?
The court provided the written copy of the instructions.
Okay.
We didn't read. There was no review of the instructions. There was an in-depth review of the instructions at the beginning of trial, and that's when we settled on modified 3.5.
But before settling the instructions on the record, all counsel had a copy?
All counsel received a copy, yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yeah, there was something about, were they emailed to you folks over the weekend or something?
It might have been emailed the night prior. I don't recall, 3 years ago now. But I don't recall exactly if it was emailed to him the night before. The point is, it was something that there was never a discussion about. It was there wasn't an objection made at the time. When it was discovered, there was an objection made.
When was that?
And that was in the post-trial briefs.
Right.
And I guess I'd again point to Turner v. Willis, and the holding there that this court has the power to recognize and overturn a jury instruction that is given in error.
If given that the trial court did in fact read the original modified 3.5, day two of the trial, so the jury heard it, what do you point to show that there clearly was confusion by the jury? I mean, because one of the instructions was if your clients hadn't proved damages with reasonable certainty, they should award a dollar, which is what they did, right?
Yes,
right. Well, at least they awarded a dollar. I don't know about the reasonable certainty part, but.
Well, okay, so the confusion comes from exactly what you just pointed out. That day two, that the judge read the modified 3.5 and stated that there was a breach of exclusivity and there was harm caused by that breach. Day five, they hear Donna Farrell's testimony, which is a separate and independent error in allowing that testimony in. Then we're not allowed to cross-examine and correct the record. So after day five, the jury goes home thinking, wait a minute, we heard on day two from the court that Gold Guys had exclusivity, and the breach of that exclusivity caused harm. Day five, they hear that we don't have exclusivity and we're unable to correct that. Day six, they see a new instruction that removes harm and removes the link between harm and exclusivity. And that is important to show why the jury was confused. What happened, right? What happened between day five and, or day two and six? The only thing that happened was Donna Farrell's testimony on this issue about the fact that we did not have any exclusivity. And so how could our damages be foreseeable if they were caused by a right that the court now, that the jury now hears we didn't have?
Go ahead, sorry.
On the record, did Donna Farrell actually testify Gold Guys did not have exclusivity, or did she testify who typically had?
Both.
She said you do not have exclusivity.
Yes, Your Honor. She said both. First, when she was being directed by Attorney Sugimura, she said, who typically had exclusivity to the exclusion of Gold Guys, clearly, and then we're unable to correct that. On cross-examination, she says it was her understanding that Gold Guys did not have exclusivity, and that's when we had the bench conference about cross-examining her with the finding, with the fact that we did have exclusivity, that Gold Guys did have this right, and we were precluded from doing so. And at the conclusion of that bench conference, the trial court stated the last statement in that bench conference, and I want to point it out because respondents go to lengths to make an argument that we somehow acquiesced to a corrective jury instruction, which we never received, in lieu of the right to cross. The last thing Judge Nakasone said was, so you can question, but I'm not going to allow any of that. Don't talk about radius, okay, so it's not being allowed. And in the hearing post-trial, she acknowledged, this is where she acknowledged that the not allowing the cross-examination was an error, and in her words, she shut it down, meaning she shut the cross-examination down.
Counsel, your red light is on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. On every major issue of this case, Gold Guys got exactly what they asked for. The only thing they didn't get was a jury who believed their evidence. Three fundamental principles resolve this appeal in Ward's favor. First, in order to preserve error, you must object below. Here, Gold Guys didn't do that with the testimonial evidence, and they agreed to the jury instructions, including modified 3.5. They even read it to the jury in their closing. After trial, counsel even called it a fine instruction. Second, jury instructions are interpreted as a whole, and absent proof that they are misleading, prejudicial, or erroneous, there is no error. Here, Gold Guys repeatedly agreed to modified 3.5, and their briefs are devoid of any showing that the instructions are misleading, erroneous, or prejudicial. Finally, nominal damages do not show that the jury was confused. It just shows the jury didn't believe your evidence, and we know that from the Ferreira case from our briefs. In order to prevail, you would have to show that the verdict was palpably not supported by the evidence. And the converse of that is that if there's any evidence to support if the jury's verdict that the jury heard, then the verdict should stand. Here, the jury heard Gold Guys' witnesses and saw their exhibits, and they didn't believe Gold Guys was damaged. We showed the jury a lot of evidence about why Gold Guys' business failed. The record shows that the jury heard from witnesses that the price of gold fell, that Gold Guys stopped advertising, that other Gold Guys stores across the nation failed as well. Any evidence along these lines supports the jury's verdict because it's consistent with the verdict, and therefore Gold Guys has not met the palpably not supported test. As to the primary points of appeal, the testimony of Donna Farrell and the jury instructions, neither point carries the day and fails for the same reason, failure to object below. Your Honor, you asked about the standard of review for the Donna Farrell examination was, it's abuse of discretion, it's in our papers. And in this situation, the trial court not had one opportunity to review the decisions made at trial on these evidentiary issues, but she did it twice. And both times she found that the admission, the objections were properly overruled and the evidence was properly excluded. The trial court permitted testimony about exclusivity because Gold Guys insisted that the 2012 lease was brought about under duress. And so whether that term was rent amount, the color of the awnings, whatever, any back and forth negotiation is fair game because it shows that the contract was not entered into under duress. And at this point in time, Ward had the burden to prove that we actually had a contract with Gold Guys to prove up our claim under the 2012 lease.
What was the reason that counsel needed to go into on direct with Ms. Farrell, the reaction of Gold Guys to the leasing to secured buyers, which led up to, which is the prelude to the then contested testimony?
Correct, and the purpose was it showed that there was a back and forth to show there was no duress. This court asked whether there were emails mentioning back and forth before the lease was signed, and I invite the court's attention to footnote 5 of our brief. And I can give you a record. It's page 5 of our answering brief to the supplemental opening brief, docket 180. And it recounts our evidence, which shows that it was pre-lease signing, going back and forth between Mr. Beasy. Trial exhibit JT number 14, which is docket 48 at 271, references Joe Beasy sending an email response that he had spoken to Donna Farrell about penciling in two additional items, including adding an exclusivity provision in the Ward Center lease. That was before the lease was signed, and therefore we think it was fair game to discuss because it showed that there was a back and forth.
I can understand that part.
Yes, sure.
The part about the reaction as a result of secured buyers going into Ward Warehouse, that's the part I'm curious about.
And first off, I don't recall that they objected to that testimony.
That's true.
Okay. Which is necessary predicate in order to preserve under the rules of evidence.
But all of this is context, right? All of this is context. I'm just trying to understand the context of this six-day trial.
Yes, sure.
Yeah.
So the context being that they want summary judgment, and there is a significant prejudicial impact because the trial court, by granting summary judgment, found facts, which is classically the constitutionally protected role of juries in our court system. And so there was definitely a need, because we would be harmed if all they could talk about was how they were bad, how they were breached. That has nothing to do with contract damages. Their claim for punitive damages has been dismissed. So how we breached was irrelevant at that point because the trial court had already found there was a breach and instructed the jury that there was a breach.
Well, this is a question that I wanted to ask. You've led right into it, which is, how is a jury to determine what damages are if they know there's a breach, but they don't know what the breach arose from? You know, I mean, so they breached in the ultimate jury instruction. There it says there's a breach of the 2011 license agreement. The parts that is taken out is the breach was because there was a license to secured go buyers.
Correct.
Secured buyers.
And the word exclusivity did not appear in that deleted sentence.
Well, but I guess my question is, in the evidence, maybe you can help me this way,
yes, sure.
Counsel, in the evidence throughout the trial, was it clear to the jury as to why there was a breach of the 2011 license agreement?
Yes, sure.
And how was that?
And
Why there was a breach? Because of secured buyers going into Ward Warehouse.
The jury definitely knew about secured gold buyers, Your Honor. The Gold Guys, when we look at their damages case went into the jury unfettered by anything, and we tried a lot to keep that damages case away from the jury.
By Mr. Lauda?
By Dr. Lauda, yes, Your Honor.
Dr. Lauda.
He had issued his report before Gold Guys even brought up the 2011 license agreement as the theory of their case. Before that, the counterclaim was all about the 2012 lease. And it was only in October 2015, when, or maybe in September, within that time frame, that they brought a claim in summary judgment of the breach of the radius provision of the 2011 license. Dr. Laudat never updated his report. So Dr. Laudat's report and all the testimony that the jury heard was all about as if we had breached every contract with Gold Guys. It was lost profits for both stores. It was lease extension through 2020, which is ultimately what they asked the jury for. And all the damages arose from assuming all these contracts, the 2012 lease for both Ward Center and Ward Warehouse, all went in. So to say that they were harmed by the court not allowing this exclusivity discussion, these are contract damages. So lost profits went into the jury. Admin costs, legal expenses, whatever, all of that went to the jury. Dr. Laudat reviewed every expense and way of harm, and lost profits is a biggie, the biggest component of their damages.
Point, though, is that his testimony and reports were as if they breached all of the agreements,
right.
2011, the two 2012s.
Right.
I think there was another one, too. I don't know if there's the 2010.
Correct.
So
he had assumed the lease only ran until 2015. He had assumed, and the damage number that counsel asked of the jury assumed a renewal to 2020, even though the lease has an anti-renewal provision in it.
So it wasn't specific to the 2011 license agreement, which included the exclusivity provision.
And so we tried to point that out.
Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's exactly it. From our perspective, if you drill down into what the 2011 license was not for their retail store. It was a separate one for what we call the storage space across the hall. There's zero evidence that the square footage that was the subject of the 2011 license agreement was ever used for active buying of gold. We tried to eliminate, because Dr. Laudat didn't confine his damage opinion to the actual store which we were litigating or to that space in the 2011 license agreement. He said, all in, this is, you know, an enterprise theory type of damages. And so from our perspective, Gold Guys could present no more evidence of damage than what actually went in. And I challenge, let's turn to the trial examination. First off, I only saw where when Ward was examining Donna Farrell, Gold Guys objected 8 times. 4 times were sustained and the evidence didn't come in. 1 time the court instructed, and in fact I think it was the text of, or the language which counsel was referring to earlier, that she struck it from the record, and therefore the jury is presumed to follow the court's instruction and disregard the evidence. So only 4 questions were overruled, and 3 were foundational questions about the license versus the lease, and because they insisted on a duress defense over our objection, they asked for that. They insisted on duress defense, and therefore, it's fair game to talk about whatever terms were being negotiated because it undercuts that defense.
Is it fair to say, in that the whole colloquy, or you know, at the bench, during the objections?
Yes, sir.
There are references to, well, I'm going to read the instruction, the 3.5 yes. instruction. I mean, is it fair to say that the reference at that point was the only one at that point that anybody had, well, maybe not, was the one that was in the January 11, 2016 order?
Correct. And turning to 3.5, the model 3.5, which is on the judiciary's website, doesn't have that language.
Mm-hmm.
The language appeared in the trial court's order,
mm-hmm.
and it was read to the jury, and it was cited by Gold Guys in their openings. That deleted text did not mention exclusivity. It says, it has been determined that Plaintiff Ward Center breached the 2011 license agreement and harmed defendant Gold Guys when Plaintiff Ward Center's sister company, Ward Warehouse, licensed space to a secure gold buyers, a competitor of defendant Gold Guys. That's it. And so the court, at the jury settlement instructions, circulated new jury instructions, and Gold Guys agreed, modified 3.5 is fine. Then later on that day.
Sorry, but it's clear in the record that there was no indication or, I mean, other than having received it, obviously, there was no discussion that this original modified 3.5 was further modified at the point in time that there was no objection to the ultimate instruction.
Later on in the same settlement conference, I think it was counsel asked, was modified 3.5? And the judge said, and I quote, the one I gave you today. And he said yes. So that's, let's look at the other opportunities they had. The court's clerk over the weekend emailed again the jury instructions and the special verdict form, and that is an exhibit on the motion for new trial, docket 46 at 362. We objected to a provision in, I think it was the special verdict form, and counsel says that the court correctly adopted modified 3.5. So they had the opportunity to review it again over the weekend. The instructions were again emailed on Tuesday before they were actually going to be read to the jury. It's the same modified 3.5. Then in the final closing, we did JMAL motions before the jury came back in, and the court asked, are there any further objections to the instructions of the form? And Gold Guy said, nothing further. That's a docket 34 at 8 to 9. In the argument on the JMALs, and I'd like to quote counsel, and again we have an instruction that the court has prepared based on 3.5, where the court is going to read, and the parties did not object to that instruction. And he continues on, this is docket 34-11. We agreed on that instruction, and now that instruction is in a special verdict form. And then he continues on page 12, and it is the correct instruction. And then ultimately, Gold Guys read modified 3.5 to the jury in their closing. So I counted up 6 different opportunities where they could have been rejected, an objection to modified 3.5. Ultimately, modified 3.5 looks more like the court's original 3.5 than the earlier one. And it's because there's prejudice to the losing party in a summary judgment motion as to having a case. These are contract cases, it's not tort cases, and there's no punitive damage claim anymore. And so contract, your damages are your damage, lost profits, admin expense, whatever else. And all that evidence went into the jury over our strenuous repeat objections. And so to say that this one sentence somehow taints and causes jury confusion when their entire damages case came in without any constraint based on 2 motions in limine, trial court objections, to the irrelevance, to the lack of data, bad data, et cetera, all that, they got to present their full damages case to the jury, and the jury didn't believe it.
So damages as to other parts of the counterclaim were still an issue at the trial. In other words, beyond the exclusivity provision.
And I'd like to clarify one thing, Your Honor. Exclusivity and radius are 2 different concepts in commercial leases, and our brief kind of talks about that.
We're all using it as the right kind of synonymous.
Correct.
Right. There was a radius restriction.
There were radius words in the 2011 license agreement. On top it says non-exclusive. And so that's the subject of our conditional cross appeal, where if this case goes back down, we think that's fair to go to the jury because we think that radius provision doesn't say what the court found it to say. But, I forgot you had exclusivity and radius. So, exclusivity, because it was a negotiated term in the 2012 lease and it was subject to the back and forth, it's necessarily fair game. And our questions were constrained to that point. And they pointed to nowhere where they objected to a question where the judge didn't sustain it. As to the cross-examination, I counted 4 times where Gold Guy's cross-examination was stopped. The first time was the sidebar conference, and Gold Guy said, as long as there's instructions. One was for an asked and answered, and the question was asked and answered earlier, and the other 2 related to their attempt to bring up the word exclusivity, which wasn't part, exclusivity in the 2011 license agreement, which wasn't part of what Donna Ferrella testified to. Absent any other showing that they objected, the trial court had no ability to sustain the objection, move to strike, et cetera, which they did, the trial court did, on Donna Ferrella's examination. Which is at docket 67, pages 16 to 17, where Ward's counsel asked, what was your response? And Donna Ferrell responds, my response was that we typically don't do that. She's talking about exclusivity. And then she continued on, they, Gold Guys, were a temporary license agreement tenant, and we don't remove a tenant because another tenant is happy. And she continued on. Counsel stands up. Your objection, Your Honor, move to strike. And the court sustained the objection. The portion of the response after the first sentence is stricken, and the jury is instructed to disregard it. She cured the harm. Ultimately, Gold Guys got all that it asked for. It demanded a jury, despite the jury waiving the lease, it got it. It demanded Dr. Laudette's testimony over objection, it got it. It demanded summary judgment over objection, it got it. It demanded a consolidated trial, objecting to our motion to bifurcate the trial and avoid the potential spillover. All these things Gold Guys got, and they agreed to those, and they had six opportunities to object to the jury instructions, and they did not do it a single time. They got everything they asked for except for the result from the jury. I think I've answered all the questions.
I just want to kind of backtrack to one of the questions I had, which is that with regards to the question of Gold Guys' counterclaim that was in issue at trial. So the summary judgment was specifically as to just the 2011 license agreement. There was a breach, and the only thing left was damages as to the breach of that 2011 license agreement.
Correct, Your
Honor. Was there anything that survived as to the counterclaim beyond that that reached trial? Just damages as to the 2011 license agreement?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
They had a tortious interference claim that was dismissed.
Those were all dismissed,
yes,
right? Pre-trial?
Correct.
Okay.
Either withdrawn, and they did file a second amended counterclaim.
That narrowed it down.
In that December timeframe.
Okay.
My last point, and I know that talking about assumption in attorney's fees is not why most judges come to work. We do think that the trial court, Ward's motion for attorney's fees was cut down when the trial court essentially found that both parties prevailed. We think under the text of HR 607-14 and the Supreme Court's decision in the food pantry case, in a contract action, in an action in the nature of assumption, there can be only one prevailing party. And the food pantry test is on balance which party prevailed. If you compare the closing request, or the closing arguments, and the damages requested by Gold Guys versus the damages requested by Ward, it's plain that Ward prevailed, and the fee request should not have been cut down.
Well, can we, I would ask you this then.
Yes, sure.
Why should we even reach the attorney's fees issue when the order was entered more than 90 days after the motion was filed?
Yes, Your Honor. And this case presents what was a situation that the Supreme Court ultimately changed the rule. And the new rule, effective January 1st of this year, clarifies what the status of post-90-day orders are. And directs the clerk to 5 days after the 90 days runs notify the parties. That's HRAP 4 now. But the timing of this is important to discuss. And there was a final judgment in this case, which the appeals were, several appeals were taken from, and it was August 2016, after the orders. And so this court, in its earlier order, considered the first judgment to be an appealable judgment. And we disagreed with that, and we litigated that a bit. But the point being that the final judgment was swept up and caught all the pretrial orders. And so It's first off, I do need to point out all of the court's orders on Gold Guy's motion for a new trial, on Gold Guy's motion for costs were entered into after the 90 days. So for them to come and claim that they are somehow harmed, there's a bit of an unclean hands situation there. Nevertheless, from our perspective, it is entirely interlocutory. All these orders are interlocutory and are subsumed by the final judgment, which was entered into in August of 2016, after all the orders. And finally, as an efficiency and practicality, 607-14 is a mandatory award. The statute says shall. And as this court and the Supreme Court did in the Coupe case, which we cited to our briefs, it's reversible error not for the court not to rule on motions for attorney's fees because it's a mandatory award. And so we're in the situation of Gold Guy's complaining that the order was too late, and yet if we're here, the remedy for that would be to remand to the circuit court for ruling on this mandatory award, which we know how she would rule because she did it in a way that causes no harm and in a way that the Supreme Court changed the rule. And so it's very clear going forward after January 1st, 2019, how these post-90-day orders should be taken. Finally, this Kuma case says that there's, it's not a jurisdictional issue until there's a written order. And so it's a problem in search of a solution which has already been made.
So there's been a ruling already on jurisdiction in this appeal.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right. Not specifically necessarily as to the attorney's fees issue, but as to jurisdiction, as to the appeal and cross appeal.
Right? Right.
Okay.
And it was mostly, I think, on the timing of briefing as the result of what the court's earlier ruling was.
Around the time of the consolidation?
Yes, sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Your Honor, if I may, I'd like to respond first to the issue on the fees that you just covered that. Here, respondent filed its motion for attorney's fees, costs, and prejudgment interest on February 23rd, 2016. The 90-day time period ended on May 24th, 2016. The court held a telephone conference on July 8th, 2016 to talk about the fact that this time period had run and ask if Gold Guys would waive that time period running in that deadline, and Gold Guys respectfully declined. Despite recognizing the legal bar posed by this deadline, the court issued an order anyhow. The rule says that the motion is deemed denied and any further order is annulled. There was a case that came out of this court, the Century Campus case, which actually came out after the briefing, but we've provided it to this court this morning. We provided a copy, and we provided a copy to Mr. Murakami as well. And that case says there is nothing in Sakuma to suggest the trial court may grant a post-judgment motion after it has been deemed denied under 4A3. So the court can issue an order acknowledging that it is denied, in effect, by waiting on the order, but it can't issue an order indicating that it's granted that after the 90-day deadline. So any later order is a nullity. And so I don't want to spend the limited period of time I have here talking about what impact that has on the conditional cross appeal, because I think the panel found that the deadline for starting the 90 days, the 30 days running, started from the order that is a nullity. And I think in light of Century Campus, that can't be the answer. The answer is not that it started on the date that the 90 days expired. We understand that, but it can't be based on the order that was.
Mr. Larson, I'm particularly interested in, with regards to the trial and the damages, what evidence there was to indicate to the jury that any damages were specifically related to the breach of the 2011 license agreement because secured buyers had moved in.
Yes, Your Honor. Before I answer that, I just want to point out that all of these arguments that respondents have made assume that our only argument on appeal is a motion for a new trial, and that our only argument and the only standard that is applicable is that the decision is against the manifest weight of the evidence. If that were our only argument, then this would be the one issue that we'd be concentrating on today. But there are the three separate errors, and if it's more probable than not that those errors impacted or prejudiced this outcome, that's it. Then we move on to a new trial. The answer to your question, though, is that Dr. Lauda testified specifically that this harm was caused by the secured gold guy, the secured gold buyer's license, and the fact that the timing of the harm started when, in his analysis, started from the date of the secured gold buyer's license starting. So when the competition began, and again, we were in this twilight zone where we were unable to talk about exclusivity. We were unable to explain exactly why that was harmful. We were unable to talk about the exclusivity in the order. But Mr. Beasy did explain why it's important to have protection from competition for a business like this. That is in the record. And it's extremely important for a business like this because all they really have is they have recognition, they have credibility, and they have accessibility. It's not a store that sells a differentiated product. So if you put a competitor right on your doorstep, they're necessarily going to cannibalize one another. And that testimony came in, and that testimony was linked to Dr. Laudat's report and his analysis. And so he presented different numbers. One of the numbers was present damages, starting from the secured gold buyer's breach through the end of the lease period, because that's certain. Gold guys had a right to be there during that period of time. Then he extended a future damages analysis beyond that and said, well, it's reasonable to assume that both parties are going to behave in an economically responsible way. And if Ward is receiving their rent, and if Gold Guys is continuing to do what they've been doing, then why wouldn't they continue on for at least 5 years past the initial lease period? That was the testimony. But
Mr. Larson, unless my colleagues have any questions, your light is on.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, we'll take this matter under advisement. Thank you very much.